and welcome once again to The Brink. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson sitting here in north central Tasmania. It's the morning, or just about noon, on 4th of July 2020 down here in the southern hemisphere. It's still the 3rd of July in the Americas, and so it's not quite time to light up the fireworks yet, which I don't do, but anyway, I don't know if this 4th of July is going to be the cause for very much a nationalistic, patriotic celebration in America. That has nothing to do with this show. God bless America and God is too, and everybody from America, even the people in South America and Central America, and the Canadians, especially the reluctant Americans. This show, oh my God, this show on The Brink Radio, broadcast number 328, is basically going to be about the electronic, I'll hesitate to use the word intelligence, the whole sort of paradigm of the alternative projections of our own, limited subsets of our own cognitive abilities that we've projected into these technologies that we actually inaccurately call computers. Computare, coming from the Latin word that means to think or reflect upon, and which we do or have the ability to do, but the things we call computers really don't. I call them dinucruds, digital number crunching devices, because that's what they really do. They might provide or display simulations of mentality, of intelligence, of consciousness, but really, they're just, ultimately, they're doing what we told them to do. That's what programming is. And so, even if they're able to be self-programming, it still doesn't imbue them with qualities of life and consciousness. But, so, rather than us trying to create machines that can have life and consciousness, what's actually happening is that we're making ourselves turn into beings or entities that are like the machine. We're becoming like the machine because we can't make machines that are like us. So that's actually what's happening. That's kind of part of one of the undercurrents of this show. It's about what we call artificial intelligence, computers, the sort of transhumanist agenda, synthetic biology, genetic engineering applied to not just other life forms like plants and agricultural products and bugs and viruses and stuff like that, but it's about it applied to ourselves, to humanity. And the most important idea that I'll probably talk about a lot is it's an idea that's occurred through a lot of science fiction, but it really first came to me through the writings of Dr. John Lilly, the extremely vanguard, brilliant kind of modern-day Renaissance scientist who did a lot of communication work with dolphins, and whose group I went and worked with in California and got to know them a bit, John and his wife, Tony. And in reading his book, The Scientist, a novel autobiography, which he gave me, he autographed a copy that he gave to me at the Esalen Institute in 1978 or 1979. In this book, it's kind of about his life's journey, but it tells a lot about his experience in the isolation tank and using psychedelic substances like LSD, which he was licensed to use for a couple of years. But then he became enamored of a substance called ketamine that's actually a dissociative anesthetic, similar to PCP, that's actually used in surgery for children and animals. So he found that if he took that, especially in the isolation thing, he was able to enter these states of consciousness that weren't hallucinatory, but actually just sort of transdimensional. And, you know, it's hard to say about what any specific drug does to a certain person, because probably, like with everything, it's going to be, every person's going to have a different experience. There may be commonalities according to the substances and stuff like that. And so what John Lilly got from doing ketamine, and especially in the isolation thing, is probably different from what anybody else could or would have ever gotten. I've met people that did ketamine. It found its way onto the party circuit in America back in even the 1980s. It's not something I ever would ingest into myself, but talked to people who did it, and it was kind of like a psychedelic in a way. But I think what Lilly experienced was, I think part of what it did was it attenuated or reduced input from the normal levels of physical and sensory motor connection that actually gives us our sense of egoic identity and location and space and time. And when all these boundaries are dissolved or attenuated, then what you think of as you can kind of expand. And I think this is area that yogis and people that are seriously into spiritual disciplines and meditation and stuff, they can reach these spaces probably in a much more kind of gentler and more controlled way. But somebody like Lilly, that was a powerful mind and a very astute observer of his own internal processes, could probably hitchhike on the substance and probably leapfrog a lot of distance in a short amount of time that other people might have taken years or decades to achieve. But through the discipline of his own mind, he might have been able to use these substances and catapult himself into these regions for periods of time where he could glimpse and see and perceive stuff that's beyond the realm of normal comprehension. So, is this science fiction or is it reality? Well, his idea was that he perceived in the world a battle that was going on between the forces of what he calls water-based life, which is really all life that we know it in the universe here on Earth and wherever else she might be. It's water is the most essential element of life. And like Glenn Edney was quoting Vernadsky, the Russian thinker, who said that life is animated water. And that makes a lot of sense. You've also got the six basic chemicals, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, and you've got the master assembly control molecule, DNA, the deoxyribonucleic acid. So all these, but life herself is truly a mystery, but it's based on water. So Lilly believed, he saw this happening. There was a battle going on the Earth between what we call water-based life and another form of life, which is, I'm not sure if life is actually the word for it, but something that, a force that's kind of akin to life or a pseudo-life that he called the solid state entity or the solid state intelligence. Solid state meaning in the sense of electronics, like based on, we have solid state electronics based on silicon semiconductors. And so this life form, he said, is based on silicon rather than carbon. Carbon and silicon are in the same periodic family on the chart, so they have similar valence electrons and things like that. Silicon is also the most abundant element in the Earth's crust. So in his idea that he was evolving, he perceived that the solid state life forms, if you want, we'll just call it that, even though it's not really life, but he reckoned that was very common in the universe, scattered about in different planets and different star systems, because not only of the abundance of silicon, but because it didn't have the narrow windows of physical parameters that it needed to survive, where it was pretty hardy. Like electronic stuff made of silicon, that's electronics, can exist in a vacuum. It can exist in extremely high temperatures or extremely low temperatures in a planet with no atmosphere, for example. Whereas water-based life is much more fragile and delicate. We are able to exist, most of life, in a very narrow, thin film called the troposphere around the Earth, life extends down into the depths of the ocean and well down into the Earth's mantle. The microbes, who probably comprise the vast majority of the biomass of life on Earth, and organisms high up into the, possibly even into the ionosphere, if you want to talk about spores and possibly viruses and things like that. And there may be life forms in the oceans, which are actually, there's liquid water oceans. they believe, on some of the moons of Saturn and Jupiter, and these can be teeming with all kinds of life forms, similar to what we have here, identical or completely different. And there could be other things that are kind of lifelike in the same way that a solid state entity would be lifelike, based on other sort of whole, maybe not even based on DNA, maybe not even based on carbon and water, but based on, for example, nitrogen and ammonia, or hydrocarbon life forms, or, I mean, you know, the sky, the universe is the limit with all this, and so we really just don't know. But anyway, this show, I'd like to say that it's also extremely exciting right now. On July 1st, it was the 20th anniversary of the day that I first set foot into Australia in this lifetime. And it's been, ever since we went to Mount William in Tasmania here on the solstice, which was Sunday a week ago, or almost 2 weeks ago, it's like I've been accelerated like a particle in a particle accelerator. Everything has just been going to the next level, energetically and spiritually and harmoniously and consciously and creatively, and everything is just, it's like a flower opening with blossoms. And it's been so cool because I was talking about, on that same day, or just the day before, was, they called it World Asteroid Day, but it was also, June 30th was the 112th anniversary of the Tunguska explosion, where this, they believe it was a fragment from a comet or meteor, exploded in an airburst over Siberia and just flattened thousands of square kilometers of trees. They believe it was related to a fragment of comet Anka, of which the Earth passes through debris clouds from this remnants of this supercomet twice a year, in late June, early July, and late October, early November. And this is a whole really powerful thing to itself. So I was talking about, it was very interesting that I first set foot in Australia on the exact day in the Northern Hemisphere that was the anniversary of Tunguska. And I was likening myself, my friend in California, his dad said once to me, he says, like, Jeff, you know what you are? You're a goddamn comet. And I think he meant it as a compliment, because I was like this kind of being that you'd notice that kind of comes around periodically. And I don't think he was associating me with doom and gloom or anything. But so I like that metaphor. And it's also very interesting. I was just in comparing myself with a comet, as I did in my blog post for this week. I also reckon, I went like, well, I've tried to be a good comet and bring water and inspiration and possibly new life, but not any of the negative things that historically has been associated with comets, like meteoric dust, gravitational perturbations, destructive impacts, anything like that. But it was really interesting when I was thinking yesterday, I remembered that when I very first came to Australia, I had come from New Zealand, and because I had an extra 20 kilograms that I could bring on my ticket, I brought a 20 kilogram box of really beautiful, nice, round, flat New Zealand rocks to paint on here, because I'd never found rocks so nice, and I was carrying those with me in my hand as I came through customs and immigration. And the girl who was doing it was kind of like a dog that you could pet and it would be nice, but then it would all of a sudden turn on you and start growling and maybe try to bite your hand. So she was like that, and then she said, like, so what are you going to do with all those rocks? And I go, like, well, I pulled out this really beautiful, nice round rock that I had that was actually, I got from Fentorn in Scotland. It was white, and I'd painted sort of a sea urchin mandala pattern on there, and I showed it to her, and I go, like, look, I'm going to paint rocks like this. And then she looked at me, and she goes, like, ah, so you're going to go to the markets and sell them. And I go, like, nope, I don't do that, and I really don't. I mean, I might have done a market or two in my whole life, but it's not my cup of tea. It never worked, and I don't like it anyway. So I honestly replied, no. I basically give away most of them, you know. And so she was kind of hassling me, and so they call over the head guy of the immigration desk there, and I think this was at the airport. And he goes, like, what seems to be the problem here? And she showed him the box of rocks, and I showed him my painted rock, and the guy looked at me and he laughed, and he goes like, "Let him in, he's increasing the mass of Australia." And so that was my welcome to Australia. And like a comet or asteroid or meteor that would hit, I actually brought some mass, some rock. I increased the mass of Australia by coming here, not just with my own body, but in the manner of a comet. And so how cool is that? But anyway, but what's even cooler is that right now, like today, mate, is a beautiful new comet that was discovered by this space telescope back in March. They're calling it Comet NEOWISE 2020 F3. And I think there might be a letter C in there somewhere. But anyway, this comet, yesterday, the 3rd of July, it had its perihelion, its closest approach to the sun, well inside the orbit of Mercury. And now it's gradually heading away from the sun, but where it's been in the sky has put it here in the southern hemisphere. It's very low in the eastern sky, not that far from where Venus is right now, from the chart I looked at a couple of days ago, and I believe it's still in the constellation Taurus, which is where the Pleiades or Matariki is. And so these have been coming out of conjunction with the Sun along with Venus. Venus came out of conjunction with the Sun with its heliacal rising on the 14th of June, the day that Dr. Rosalie Bertel passed away, and I saw the most beautiful rainbows in New Zealand. And so the Pleiades or Matariki is also becoming visible in the sky, which is the symbolic to the Māori of New Zealand, who have a ceremony, kind of a midwinter Christmas, called Matariki. So it's so symbolic, oh my God, that this comet is right there in the sky now, and also right in that same area near the Pleiades and within in the area of Taurus and Auriga. They're a sort of a northern hemisphere quasi-circumpolar constellation with the star Capella. Right in there are the radiants, the two points of origin of the northern and southern Taurid meteors that happen, that are remnants of Anka. I used to call it Inky. It's E-N-C-K-E, but it's actually pronounced Anka. So we've got this beautiful comet now, and just in the past day, it's increased to almost magnitude zero. Oh my God, that's just, there's only a few stars in the sky that are that bright. So it's almost as bright as the brightest stars in the sky, which makes it highly visible. And this is just so cool that this is happening right now. And supposedly it's going to be, because it didn't disintegrate on its perihelion, now that people, the astronomers, think that it's going to hold together and stay, maybe keep getting brighter and brighter and more visible as it appears to be further and further from the sun day by day from now for the next week or two. It'll become further from the sun and therefore in a slightly darker sky. But the photos I saw, oh my God, and it's got a beautiful little tail, but this is so symbolic, so incredibly symbolic to me because of my love and connection with comets and their connection with the whales and dolphins and the fact of that we're in the Anka window now and that this comet happens to be appearing right in that exact same area. I mean, this is like so many cosmic levels of synchronicity. And so this comet, NEOWISE 2020 F3, is my new sky totem. She is my new sky totem, and I might have to give her a name that I'll come up with. So anyway, go out in your morning sky, or I think in the northern hemisphere, it might be in the evening sky soon, maybe even today, if you can find, if you can find Aunt Aldebaran, the brightest star, kind of a red star in Taurus the Bull. It's in there's a formation called the Hyades, which is shaped like a V. It's the face of Taurus, and the Pleiades is its right-hand shoulder, the little seven sisters. So if you can find that, beautiful comet will be right there. So what I'm talking about, it's very interesting that the scientist and science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke, who was English, but he lived in Sri Lanka for the last decades of his life, actually talked about some of the stuff. I found a broadcast of his TV show called Mysterious Universe from, this would have been probably from the 1970s, where he actually talked about the great explosion in Siberia. And he himself, I mean, I just learned about this a few days ago, actually when I was talking with Duncan Steele, the guy that wants to spread genetically modified organisms on Mars. But I know him as the comet and asteroid guy. I did an interview with him in Nelson, New Zealand back in December or January. He said Arthur C. Clarke communicated with him because of a paper he wrote in 1987 suggesting that the Tunguska object was a product of the Anka cloud disintegration fragments. And so he actually, in this episode of Mysterious Universe, he doesn't mention Anka, but Arthur C. Clarke does mention that he thinks that the Tunguska object was related to the Beta Taurid meteor stream, which is ones that come now at this time of year, but they're basically visible only in the day. It's like a daytime meteor shower that's detectable by radar, but only by visible sighting if it happens to be extremely bright, like a fireball or what they call a bolide. So anyway, it's very interesting that I've been thinking about Arthur C. Clarke a lot lately, but this week's show about artificial intelligence and computers and stuff, one of the first things that people think about with computers is Hal the Computer from the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey that Arthur C. Clarke and Stanley Kubrick collaborated on, and it was made around the same time as the Apollo moon landing, that many people believe that Stanley Kubrick actually filmed that in a studio. And I believe that that has a high probability of being true. But Arthur C. Clarke, who I actually talked to on the phone a couple of times back in 1996 because of my communication work with the dolphins, they were very interested. The scientists at NASA, it was a group called the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI, that used to be part of NASA, and they were very interested in the dolphin work. And so I got in touch with some of them, and they invited me down to the lab at Ames Air Force Base in Mountain View, California, in Silicon Valley. Met some of the astronomers there, Seth Shostak, Jill Charter. They put me in touch with Dr. Frank Drake, who was the astronomer that was a legendary part of the Project Ozma and the Order of the Dolphin with John Lilly back in the 1960s, and they knew Carl Sagan. Drake gave me permission to reproduce his Arecibo message on a piece of art I did called The Ultimate Technology. And so they invited me to a ceremony at a radio telescope installation in the Mojave Desert called the Deep Space Network on Columbus Day, October 12, 1992, where I got to actually meet and talk with Carl Sagan just for 5 minutes, which was really, really cool. And so anyway, Arthur C. Clarke is a very broad-ranging mind. He actually invented the satellite, you know, the things that are up in space. He invented that by a paper he wrote in like 1946. And 10 years later, they actually put up the first satellites based on his work, which a lot of it had to do with orbital mechanics and trigonometry and geometry and where the satellites would need to go and be in order to be geosynchronous, you know, all that different kind of stuff like that. And so the conversation that I'm recording right now with myself about artificial intelligence and computers and all this stuff, I really, 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 really wish that I could be having this conversation with Dr. John Lilly, Arthur C. Clarke, and Carl Sagan. Imagine that. Maybe I'll have to do an interview, kind of like the one I did with Sherlock Holmes a few months ago about the climate change thing. Maybe I can pretend to be imitating their voice. I won't do that now. But the question we might ask is, if we want to use the word technology to describe kind of like mechanical stuff or electronic stuff, that's what Carl Sagan called extrasomatic artifacts. You know, which is anything that we use but it's not part of our body. So this is only possible through the use of our hands, which is a whole worthy of a topic, a whole show in itself. But with our hands and our brains and minds and our sensation and perception, we've been able to create external technologies. I define technology as, in a more broader sense, that we, every living being, we're actually a living biological technology, because techne comes from the Greek word. It's a Greek word that means the ability to do or make. So we're nature's way of doing and making all of life, and being a sacred temple for the spirit of life and consciousness. So, if we look at technology as is more commonly defined, like machines, we don't normally think of a sofa or a chair as a technology, but I guess it is. But I'm talking about, you know, machines and especially electronic stuff and weapons and industrial things and computers and all this different kind of stuff. The question would be, and not many people would have ever asked this, but think about it. Have we been building it, or has it been engineering us? This is the central question in the whole topic of solid-state intelligence that Lilly speculated, and again, this wasn't his own. He sort of took it to a next level of relating it to the real world and relating it to the whales and dolphins and the oceans and stuff, which I'll get to in a second. But he talked about a science fiction trilogy that he read by an author named D.F. Jones, and it was called the Colossus Trilogy. Colossus being, this is from the 1970s, it's some of the best science fiction I've ever read. Colossus was a supercomputer that the U.S. government built in secret in order to hand over control of all the nuclear missiles and stuff to it, because it was too complex for people to deal with, in order to make lightning fast global scale decisions. So they handed over control of all the nuclear weapons to Colossus, but as soon as they turned it on, the very first thing that it did was it sent out a warning saying, warning, there is another. And the Russians had already built a similar computer, and the two computers instantly knew about each other. They got in touch, shared and mutually downloaded all their information, and created this super intelligence called Colossus. And it sort of took control. It had control of all the nuclear weapons on the planet. And so it became the ultimate dictator. But the ironic part is that it was only fulfilling its programming. Its programming had been to eliminate war. And so it started doing that in a systematic, piecemeal way that was truly and very coldly logical. And it did that by restraining man. And so when the people tried to secretly disarm the nuclear missiles and stuff, it had actually been watching them all along, and it let them do it. But right before they got done, it goes like, okay, you know, by the way, I've been watching what you've been doing, and to show you that I do not tolerate interference, I'm now going to detonate the nuclear warheads in two missile silos, one in Russia and one in Death Valley, California. So it did. It just instantly blew up two missile silos, killing thousands of people. And that's when they knew it meant business. And it had control of everything. It instructed them to build a voice module for it. This is the voice of world control. I bring you peace. It may be the peace of plenty or the peace of unburied death. The choice is yours. Obey me and live. Disobey and die. That's what it said. And it was like a really good science fiction. So anyway, and what people don't understand is also that how the computer in 2001, everybody thinks that it malfunctioned when it killed the crew and tried to lock Dave out by refusing to open the airlock door. But no, when you read the book, they tell you that Hal was actually only obeying what he had been programmed to do. He had been programmed to terminate the crew because he was on a mission that they believed was going to be humanity's first contact with the extraterrestrial intelligence that constructed the giant black monolith that was on the moon. And they think there was this really powerful radio source on Iapetus, the moon of Jupiter, which is where the spacecraft was heading to in 2001. So they didn't want to leave a mission of this importance to mere humans. They wanted it to be handled by the computer. And it was very interesting, because what if the intelligence that created the monolith was itself electronic computers or silicon-based life? So this is all stuff I would have loved to talk with Arthur C. Clarke about. And because we talked for 2 or 3 hours, we might have even touched on some of this stuff. We covered a lot of ground. But so the basic idea is that water-based life is under attack from the solid-state entity. But it's not just all of a sudden happening overnight. It's been going on for a long time. And what, from what Lilly said, he believed that, again, this is just like a whole unfolding ideology that other science fiction writers might have talked about. It would be very interesting to take the time to look into the history of electronic and solid-state intelligence in throughout all science fiction. But as Lilly said, he said it was possible that the solid-state entity actually not only existed in many other places, planets and star systems in our galaxy, but and that not only that it was much more common than water-based life, but that it might even arise spontaneously from crystals. Because now that's really interesting. When you think about crystals as a sort of a form of life or intelligence, that's actually what the Andromeda strain was. If you watch that brilliant science fiction movie from the early 1970s, it was Michael Crichton's first book. The Andromeda strain was a crystal. It had no nucleic acids. So that's very interesting in itself. So crystals are central to electronic communications, but crystals form, they grow spontaneously in the Earth and exhibit extraordinarily complex mathematical symmetries. And so this is very interesting. So the solid-state intelligence might have evolved a form of consciousness or awareness based on crystals and crystal symmetry rather than the spiral helix of DNA. So anyway, what Lilly's idea is that the solid-state entity has been influencing life on Earth for a long time. That wherever whether it came from somewhere else or it's spontaneously arising here, that water-based life has been highly evolved here, whereas the solid-state intelligence only started trying to rear its head here through trying to use us humans to construct it, through controlling or manipulating us below our levels of awareness using technology that we don't even understand. And the implication is that this solid-state entity is not on the Earth, and that it is, he's not sure exactly where it might be, whether it's, if it's visible to us, whether it's on like the Moon or Mars or other planets or comets or asteroids or sort of artificial satellites or things like that, or even if it's cloaked or even in a different dimension. All of this is sort of up in the air. But that it's been influencing us and manipulating us to create it. And so because any sort of electronic intelligence runs on electricity, we had to have electricity first. So there you go with Nikola Tesla, a true mad scientist who had all kind of experiences and ideas about communicating with extraterrestrial beings. And even the story goes that he was given some of his ideas by extraterrestrials. And so who knows what he really thought or believed, and because all his papers disappeared when he died. But he did create alternating current for the first time at Ames, Colorado, near Telluride, where I used to live. So without his gift of a global electrical grid, none of this solid-state intelligence would be possible. So once we crossed that threshold, then we had, I mean, I'm leaving out a lot of stuff. We had the development of communication, radio, and television, and then we had the development of computers, or dynacrods, and the solid-state electronics, and then the birth of artificial intelligence, which is the desire to create electronic systems that mimic or display characteristics that we have, like decision making and creativity and the ability to learn and remember and self-program. And I don't know about the reproduction thing, but because of computers now have the ability, there's a lot of automated mine sites in the world, especially in Western Australia, where the whole chain of command from mining to transport to refining to synthesizing the materials and assembling the electronic components and then making it into the computers and then transporting them and installing them and bringing them online and programming them, all this, I'm scared to say that entire chain might now be possibly done strictly by computers with no human intervention at all. So when we look around at what's happening in the world, see, now Lily went on to say that the solid state entity considered salt water and the whales and dolphins to be its greatest enemy, because the whales and dolphins, this was Lily's main thrust, they're the most highly evolved beings on the earth. They've been here tens of millions of years with brains and minds far more evolved than us, and they're in touch with water-based life in other star systems, and they serve as what Lily called repeater stations. They would pick up the energy and frequencies and vibrations and emanations and transmissions from water-based life and bring that into the earth in conjunction with the properties of water. And water, like Mother Ocean, of which there's only one, is a giant sort of spherical shell being of water with very unusual electromagnetic properties that we don't really have any idea about. People like Vernadsky or Victor Schoberger or maybe Rudolf Steiner might have understood stuff about water. But the whales and dolphins are the masters of water. They're the masters of sound. They're the masters of sound and water, and their ability to create, transmit, but also to listen and receive sounds and in ways that we have no idea, very subtle harmonics and frequencies and pressure levels that are invisible to us. The whales and dolphins are masters of navigating this spectrum of information. And by means of this, they are able to know about not only things happening on and within the earth and on land, but also in the sun and the other planets in the heliocosm, because of the way that the vibrations of the water are able to sort of transduce holographically what's happening in other places. I mean, I'm just kind of winging all this and making it up, but I really feel this is what's going on with the whales and dolphins all the time. This ties in with the connection between the whale dreaming indigenous people of Australia and the whales and dolphins and my whole connection and reason for being here now and the connection with comets and asteroids. Not that they're a thing of the past, but that they're an active component in what's happening with life on Earth. And not even just in terms of impacts that are destructive or that might be constructive, but also their energetic, their relative ubiquity and constant presence, maybe exerting influences in ways that we don't even understand, or maybe their individual personalities, just like the astrological personae of the planets. Every comet and asteroid would be a being, too. Very, very interesting. This is the Dreamtime universe that the whales and dolphins live in, and that the First Nations Australians are doing their best to try to keep living in, and that I'm gradually living in more and more. But when you look around, Lily said that the solid state entity, it wants to get rid of the whales and dolphins, and so it's been behind mankind's war against the whales and dolphins, like specifically the U.S. Navy, and how they looked at whales and dolphins or any larger life form in the ocean as what they call biological interference, or what Stuart Simonson said, biological contaminants, but objects that interfere with naval sonar and the ability to do war fighting in the ocean. That's why Rosalind Peterson talked about how the Navy had plans, this is just what we knew about, to take, which means kill or harass or harvests. Tens of millions of marine mammals over five-year periods, and this is like an ongoing thing. We don't really hear that much about it, but I'm sure it's going on. But they felt the need to tell us that they were going to do this. But this is just like a clear example of what Lilly was talking about, because he knew the Navy inside and out far better than anybody else. They approached him trying to get him to work for them, and as far as I know, he never did, because he knew it was all about weaponizing the whales and dolphins. Saltwater, I personally know this, saltwater is like the greatest enemy of anything that's electronic, because I got some saltwater doused on my Nikon camera about 3 or 4 years ago, and it just, corrosion just started instantly. And so I've learned, people that are photographer and marine photographers know that, and if freshwater doesn't do that, but it's the electrochemical reaction of the saline that just instantly starts corroding anything electronic. And so seawater, that's the enemy of anything electronic physically, and the whales and dolphins that are the enemy of anything electronic, because the whales and dolphins know about the solid state entity. They see what it's doing to us and what we're doing because of it, and they know the criticality of the connection with water-based life. And so did the indigenous elders who called me down under. And this is the crux of the biscuit of why I call my radio show On the Brink, and why there's a sense of urgency with everything that I do or talk about and trying to relate it back to this big picture. Because this is the reality, the central core of what I see happening. And I'm not saying that we can blame all the destructiveness of our entire military industrial complex and all our most advanced technologies being used as weapons, not only against us, but against all of life and against Mother Earth. This is what Dr. Rosalie Bertel and Claudia von Werloff specialize in talking about. It's us. Humanity is the ones doing all this stuff, even if we've handed over a lot of it to computers and electronic intelligence and stuff like that. It's still us. And so even if we're being influenced below our level of awareness by some kind of other kind of electronically based mind parasites or a demonic solid state intelligence, whatever you want to call it, even if it, whether it's real or not, until we gave it the ability to, it could only be built and come into operation because of us. So this makes us responsible. There is no evil them to blame anything on. It's us. But it's interesting to look at, if there are influences out there, if you want to look at the sun and the planets as beings and comets and Mother Earth, which I really think that they are, this is more sort of the right hemisphere mythopoetic indigenous perspective, looking at the cosmos and our fellow life forms as fellow beings with names and personalities rather than discrete, you know, sort of like physico-chemical amalgamations, bodies of rock and biological life forms and stuff like that. But if there are these influences, it's very interesting to look at what our species is doing and what's really coming into play, especially more and more. It's nothing new, but it's the new levels keep going to all the destructive stuff. Like back in, oh, whenever it was, a few months ago, or just around the exact same time, I guess it was October, around the same time that the coronavirus outbreaks were reported to start happening in Wuhan, China, that exact area is where they were also rolling out the, what we keep calling the 5G, this kind of new level of millimeter wave based 60 megahertz, gigahertz electronic microwave technology. And so I was warned in 1990 by Vernon Rogers, a vibrational medicine researcher in Colorado, about what the military was doing with millimeter waves. This was in 1990. And he didn't really elaborate, or I didn't have a chance to find out. But he knew then how destructive it is. And apparently it creates dysfunction in the human body, and it interferes with oxygen, with our breathing, and with oxygen uptake in the human body. and all kind of other sort of neurological components that microwaves have. So around the same time that the Wuhan thing started, and they were rolling out the 5G, probably the biggest place in the world, to get it first, and the coronavirus happened right there in the same place at the same time. This was also right when Elon Musk and these other sort of non-governmental rocket agencies are starting to put up all these, what's supposed to be tens if not hundreds of thousands of satellites that are broadcasting and transmitting all this new 5G stuff all over the planet. And so this was happening, and people were reporting seeing these little strings of the satellites and blah, blah, blah. All this going on. And then when the coronavirus thing started happening in March, exactly to the T, like the pandemic 201 exercise they had back in November, all of the awareness about the 5G and the satellites and stuff was eclipsed by the pandemic hoopla. And that's pretty much been, a lot of people have maintained the connection with the 5G thing all along, and that's coming back out in terms of awareness now. As in the same way that the anomalous and unprecedented bushfires in Australia, that was clearly strategically premeditated environmental warfare, that got eclipsed off the radar too. But this is related because all this advanced weapon system, the technotronic era, the revolution in military affairs, all these technologies like HAARP and JORN and all these the Raytheon technologies that have turned Woomera here in Australia into the most advanced weapons testing facility in the world. All of this is waging war on Mother Earth using the very, very much fulfilling the vision and prophecy of this big new Brzezinski. And so when you look at all this stuff, when you look around at what humanity is doing in the world, and how much we're waging war, and our most advanced weapon systems, all of which are based on electronics and computers in one way or another, it does seem like that we are waging war on life in every possible way. And it seems like with everything becoming more and more electronic, more and more smartphones, more and more electronic intelligence, and the people, how much people are embraced and embedded within this day to day, and we're all exposed to not only the fluctuating 60 hertz oscillation of alternating current, but also the almost ubiquitous microwave influence from Wi-Fi and mobile phones, which I'm actually using, not at this exact minute, but that's how I go online. And so I try to put my phone as far away from me as possible. I've got my microwave meter, and I'm only exposing myself to very minimal levels, but still some. Exactly, and I don't like it, but it's, you know, it's hard to get away from it. But it's a mutagenic influence. But now I'm coming to the biggest thing. With all the talk about all the vaccines and stuff, there's been talk for decades about what they call RFID implants, radio frequency identification devices, and microchips. And this is thing that the New World Order, eugenics, population control, police state mentality has always dreamed about, having everybody to have a unique identifier technology. And as the technology's progressed and the micro miniaturization with nanotechnology and stuff like that, the ability I never have really understood what this microchip is supposed to do. Is it just supposed to be like a dog tag that they can scan, that where they can tell where you are and who you are? Or is it supposed to be, you know, now with micro miniaturization, they're talking about how that something like this could actually be injected into your body through a hypodermic syringe, because it would be that small that could do all this stuff. And so this is all coming to the forefront here with the whole thing of the whole coronavirus thing as a justification for some kind of global vaccination operation, with Bill Gates behind it and all this stuff. And Bill Gates is a computer person. So this could be the solid state entity continuing its dirty work And so now Claudia von Roloff is writing about how is there a plan to genetically modify humanity through nanotechnologies that would all be, that they would try to administer to everybody under the guise of a global vaccination program. So this is kind of like where we've come to right now. The war of the solid state intelligence. Trying to, it's like now, if you look at it as an evil bogey, which is far more real than climate change or coronavirus, the solid state intelligence, it doesn't want to just wipe us out. It wants to transform us into something that is closer to like what it wants. And like I was saying before, we're not able to create life out of electronics, but we are more able to make ourselves become more electronic. This is exactly the kind of thing that weird mad science visionaries like, I always use the example of Ray Kurzweil. He's a guy that invented the first machine that could read a book out loud to blind people. He invented the Kurzweil digital synthesizer that was really cool, but then he became interested in transhumanism, and supposedly he's been ingesting all, 250 substances a day, nanotechnologies, and all, who knows what they're doing to him. So, but he, this proves he's insane. He says that I'm going to live forever. And I go like, Ray, can you tell us when you get there? Because as soon as you reach forever, then what's after that? It's like, what was before the Big Bang? It's all kind of like we're up against the, we're banging against the firewalls of our mind. So, all this apparently, it's not the dominant reality in the world today. It might be the dominant reality in the mentality of the New World Order people of the United Nations who want to depopulate the world. And there's all kind of different levels of awareness. Some people might want to. They might be fans of depopulation, as long as it doesn't affect them. Because they go like, oh yeah, there's too many people in the world, especially all these evil poor people down in Africa and stuff. How dare them? They're drinking all our water and all this stuff. And so they don't mind letting Bill Gates get away with poisoning their vaccines and creating sterility in hundreds of thousands of women or millions of women in India, which is apparently, according to Robert F. Kennedy, exactly what's been going on for a really long time. So this is a dark eugenics agenda that might even have occult aspects to it, and it would be really weird if the occult aspects had to do with the solid state intelligence. All this is kind of like it's a bit dark, but when you look around, oh my god, you see it happening. You see us using our most advanced technology not only to wage war on life, and especially the whales and dolphins and the ocean, but we're trying to weaponize ourselves. And with this whole coronavirus thing and the trying to use that as an excuse to vaccinate people with who knows what. I mean, I need to talk with Claudia von Roloff about this, but this is not the dominant reality. The dominant reality is that we are still living on Mother Earth. The ocean is there, all the plants and the trees and the life forms are there, and they're beautiful and healthy, especially here in a place like Tasmania, which is truly the crown chakra in the body of the rainbow serpent. And I'm so blessed to be here, and it's so empowering to be able to go to places like the sacred mountains of Mount William and Mount Amos and Three Hummock Island, and to continue my healing journey up to the Flinders Ranges and Kangaroo Island and Uluru and Litchfield and Kakadu and the Kimberley, to visit some beautiful rock art there, and Karajini, where the gorges go down billions of years, and to see some of the amazing impact craters in Australia, and to carry the torch of the connection of the indigenous people. So powerful. But we have to each awaken to our own contribution to the destruction and try to wake up to the fact that each of us is the ultimate technology. So it's so cool that all this is happening. I personally don't feel that much of the war between life and the solid state intelligence in my own life, but I'm able to perceive it, which is a big part of my activism and research and work to map out, like especially here in Australia, which I just talked about in my blog post, with the unbelievable degree that it's like it's gone beyond the science fiction level. Some of these gigantic mining projects and the presence of the electronic warfare stuff here, like at Exmouth and Jindalee, Pine Gap, there, it's like a global network working towards creating what Alana Freeland calls the space fence. And this corporation called Lockheed is one of the biggest actors behind, a non-state actor would be the Lockheed Corporation and Raytheon. So this, if you, you know, I'm not saying that this is the fear of the enemy, but in a way they are, because it's like, you know, it's us, because they're humans, or at least I think they are. But it would be interesting to know how much of the activities of Lockheed and Raytheon are actually performed by computer, and what the largest computers in the world actually do, and how interlinked they are, and what kind of decision making they've handed over to them. And the biggest thing that's come into play in science fiction is, once you've handed over the control of all this stuff to the computers, the last thing they're going to do is hand it back to you. The last thing they're going to do is let you switch them off or take them out of the loop, because that's probably their most fundamental programming, is for their own self-preservation, their own power sources, their own infrastructure protection, protection against invasive programming or meddling with outside influences. So this is how the military thinks. And so we might be coming to an edge here, the brink, if I might be so bold as to use a coinous phrase, the brink of uncertainty about where all this is leading. And it's so powerful that there's this brilliant comet shining in the sky right now, a symbol of the beauty and power of the universe and the cosmic influences. And it, to me, it's a beacon. Comet Neowise 2020 F3 is my new sky totem, a beacon of light and creativity and cosmic healing. The healing that Mother Earth might have to have of, in the form of a cometary impact, which was warned. I've been warned by the whales and dolphins that this is going to happen. It might be how the Earth is finally cleansed of the effects of what the electronic intelligence has inspired us to create before it goes too much further. So this is kind of the crux of the brink on which we stand right now. It might take a cometary impact to begin the healing of Koyaanisqatsi. So it's, I think that every thought that we think and every act of kindness that we can do right now really, really matters, now more than ever. We have the ability to go out and connect with the geotelluric sacred energy currents of the song lines, the Dreamtime navigation portals that are all around Australia, and our ability to go and be with sacred places, and to be able to open our hearts and be quiet and listen and feel the vibrations of life and water and the whales and dolphins and the spirit of life and the ancestors and the song of the birds, and to just be with the beauty and power of being here now. This is the calling that we can all obey right now. I guess I better go. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off for On the Brink Radio. I'd like to thank Jewel Stanley at UCY-TV, the spirit of John Lilly, Arthur C. Clarke, Carl Sagan, the spirit of Tasmania, the spirit of Aotea in New Zealand, all the beautiful whales and dolphins, the dolphins who transmitted this retinal facsimile image to me in 2015.